Kennedy. But it was continued again then. So now we can fast forward just a little bit past all the suttas that we have done already here. And you come to a sutta which is called the Seven Sons. I'm going to skip that sutta. And after that one, there is a sutta called Fools and Wise Men. It's a very short extract. I'm going to have a quick look at that before I go on to something else. Edmund 129, Fools and Wise Men. Okay. So, we have been looking at various ways of dealing with the defilements of the mind, how to deal with anger in particular, ill will, and then also a quick look at sensuality itself. And also yesterday we had a look at the death contemplation, old age and illness, and these kind of things. And that part of contemplation is really part of what you might call a contemplation of impermanence, anicca. Yeah? Death is one of those times where things really become very clearly anicca, impermanent. And part of that is always when you see anicca, when you see impermanence, you also see suffering. Yeah? So you see the problem when you die because things are impermanent. You suffer when you attach to them. And because you can't control them, because all this just fades away and it disappears, nothing you can do about it. Death kind of happens whether you want to or not. You also realize the idea of non-self. And the things that you own, the things that are yourself, are the things that you can't control. If you can't control something, that means that it's non-self. Especially when it disappears, right? It ceases, it doesn't exist anymore. So actually those contemplations that we looked at there are all about impermanence, really. Death contemplation is one of the very powerful impermanence contemplations. So this other sutta that I have here is actually quite a nice sutta, the Seven Sons, but it's also not so central, perhaps. It's also about impermanence contemplation. You can have a look at that yourself if you like. It's fairly straightforward to understand. But now I want to continue on and have a look at the result of all these contemplations. What happens when you contemplate all of these things in the right way? Your mind gets purified. You see that it's working. You get you are living a life of kindness and goodness in so many respects. And this is a consequence of that. This is this little paragraph in Fools and Wise Men. So this is what it sounds like. This is what it reads like. Again, when a wise person is on their chair or on their bed or resting on the ground, then the good actions that they did in the past, the good bodily, verbal and mental conduct, they cover them, overspread them and envelop them. Just as a shadow of a great mountain peak in the evening covers, overspreads and envelops the earth, so too, when a wise person is on their chair or on their bed or resting on the ground, then the good actions that they did in the past, the good bodily, verbal and mental conduct that cover them, overspreads them and envelops them. Then that wise person thinks, I have not done what is bad. I have not done what is harmful. I have not done what is wicked. I have done what is good. I have done what is wholesome. I have made a shelter from anguish. When I pass away, I shall go to the destination of those who have not done what is bad, etc. Those who have made for themselves a shelter from anguish. He does not sorrow, grieve, and lament. They do not weep the breast. Weep beating the breast and become distraught. This is the third kind of pleasure and joy that the wise person feels here and now. This is quite nice, right? If you live your life well, you just kind of come back in the evening, you sit back, and because you live well, you kind of feel naturally at ease. You feel naturally relaxed. You feel a sense of joy and happiness about your life. Yeah? And this is kind of the whole purpose, in a sense, of living well, is to have this natural sense of a gladness in your mind. And this tells us a lot about how the sila nusati, is the recollection of our conduct, a recollection of our character, recollection of the morality. It tells us a lot about how that works. And it's not something that you use a lot of power, you don't kind of sit down and reflect very hard on what you have done. If you use a lot of willpower to give rise to these kind of reflections, very often you crush that happiness as you do so. So So it's almost completely natural. You just sit back and you rest and you wait for the tiredness from the week that had been there to kind of pass away. And then as the tiredness passes away and you're resting and mindfulness comes back, the joy, the gladness and the happiness almost come automatically. So the more purified you are in terms of your sila, the more automatic this whole progress is. Nothing much you have to do. You sit back and wait. And this is why this idea of waiting and patience and allowing things to be, not feeding the fire by doing more stuff, why this is such an important part of the meditation practice. And these things tend to arrive as a consequence of not doing anything at all. And then you feel really happy. You feel just right. And then, of course, the foundation for meditation is in place as a consequence. Okay, that's just a little paragraph here, just because I like that paragraph, so I thought I would read it out. Now what I want to do is go back to the gradual training again. So go back to one of the early pages from before. And so... If you can remember that far back, we were looking at sense restraint. It seems like a long time ago now, but it's only a few days ago. And so we have just looked at the little paragraph on sense restraint in the gradual training, which begins with on seeing a form with the eye, etc. He does not grasp.
Excuse me,
Walter. Yes?
Which page?
So it's page number one. It's number 27.
Okay.
MN 27, yeah? Yeah. Gradual training here. So second page of that sutta is where we are here. Yeah. Okay, so this next paragraph starts with he becomes one who acts in full awareness, that paragraph, yeah? That's where we have come to in that sutta. Everybody okay? Can you find it? Yeah? This we are still kind of dealing with right action. Right effort. Effort and action seem so close together. Right effort on the Noble Eightfold Path. This is still the sixth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. And this that we're going to look at now is sampajanya, clear comprehension or full awareness in this particular paragraph. I've talked about this already before, but here actually it is part of the gradual training itself. And this is the standard explanation for sampajanya in the gradual training and actually throughout the suttas. And I think maybe it's just worthwhile having a quick look at this. I don't have to go into too much detail. It is reasonably straightforward. So this is what it sounds like, still part of right effort. He becomes one, or he is one, who acts in full awareness when going forward and returning. Who acts in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away. Who acts in full awareness when flexing and extending his limbs. Who acts in full awareness when wearing his robes, carrying his outer robe and bowl. Who acts in full awareness when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting. Who acts in full awareness when defecating and urinating. Who acts in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent. So the idea here is that we are dealing with the monastic practice. So all of the things that you see here are the things that a monastic, when they don't meditate or they don't do some kind of practice, these are the things the monastic typically does outside of meditation. This idea of going forward and returning, all of these things about wearing your robe and all these kind of things, that's what happens, for example, especially when you go into the village to receive alms food. Like here, when you go into the kitchen at the mealtime with your alms bowl, same kind of idea. These are the things outside of that time. And then, of course, you have all the things about eating, are there. And then you have all the things about talking, for example. Talking, of course, is part of can't avoid talking. So all of these are the things that happen outside of meditation practice. This is what this is about. So the point here is that you don't want to destroy your mindfulness. You don't want to destroy the evenness of your mind outside of meditation. You want to keep it roughly ready But when you come back to meditation, you are ready to start your meditation pretty much straight away. This is what full awareness is about. So what exactly does it mean? In what sense is there full awareness? And I think I've mentioned this before. There's two particular nice ways of thinking about full awareness. And this is from the commentaries. And this is the purpose and suitability of what we do. Yeah, so you know whether it is for the right purpose or not. And for a monastic, for example, I think when you go into the village for alms, the purpose of going into the village is not to look around and see all the nice things, or see all the nice, if you're a monk, see the nice girls or whatever. That's not the point. If you do that, you're really going to destroy your mindfulness. You're going to kind of be leading in the wrong direction. So the purpose is, you remember the purpose. You're there to receive alms. You're there to go in for that purpose. And if you remember that throughout, you do all of these things in the right way. And then if you do that, then of course when you come back again afterwards, your mind is still fairly even and fairly balanced. Same thing while you eat. You eat for a purpose. You eat just the right amount, not too much, not too little. There's a very nice little passage on the right amount of eating. This becomes very kind of monastic, but you eat just the right amount. You don't feel kind of really stuffed afterwards. You kind of have to sleep, for a long time. Nor do you eat too little, so you feel hungry. You find a beautiful balance where you eat just enough. Talking, same thing. Don't talk too much, but you do talk when you have to talk. Sometimes you have to talk. You don't just keep silent when you have to communicate with somebody. You find the right balance in these things. And if you do all of these things with the keeping at the back of your mind the idea of the Noble Eightfold Path, the idea of how to make progress on the path, and you do these things in the right way, with the right attitude, so that it actually doesn't kind of disturb your practice. So this is the purpose of this. And this is something you can do in lay life as well, right? At least to some extent you can do this also in lay life. You can ask yourself whether the things that you do are suitable, whether they actually have the purpose to carry you forward, or whether they are destructive for the path. Do you do things that tend to give rise to defilements? Or do you do things that tend to reduce the defilements? If you go to the casino, then... I'm sure nobody here goes to the casino. I'm absolutely sure about that. But I'm just using it as a silly example because it kind of sounds... Some people do this. Some people love to go to the casino. But usually, casinos are terrible places. They give rise to all kind of terrible defilements. And it makes you poor at the same time. It's a very bad combination. You become poor, losing money, and it gives rise to defilements. So couldn't get much worse than that. So these are the things you ask yourself. But even if you don't go to the casino, you may do other things in life which are not really may not be the best way of spending your time. So ask yourself about these things. And if, when you do that, you can kind of gradually move your interest in a different direction. And you see, I sometimes see Buddhist lay people who've been living as Buddhists for a long time and taking the practice very seriously. And they live very beautiful lives, almost like monastics sometimes, very even. They're not really interested in watching TV, that kind of, all the nonsense you see on TV. They live very even and beautiful lives. And this is what happens, I think. After you've been a Buddhist for a long time and you try this practice, your mind just naturally moves in a different direction. Your interests change. Your interests go in a completely different way. And part of that simply happens through the reflection on the sutta, reflection on what works, and the priorities that you give to the practice of all these other things. Natural thing that happens by itself. This is something that you can use in your lay life as well, the idea of this purpose and suitability. There's a couple of things down here which are interesting, because I think actually this translation here by the good Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi are not 100%. I said yesterday I took Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi as my teacher. There comes a point when the student starts to kind of complain about the teacher and kind of say, listen teacher, maybe you have got something slightly wrong here. Which is good, right? It's probably a good thing that these things happen. And one of the problems with this that you see here, at the very end there, it says, one who acts in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, right, waking up. Actually, these two words, falling asleep and waking up, don't mean that. What they mean, the Pali word behind falling asleep is sutte. Sutte means asleep. Yeah, and waking up means awake. So, if this translation is correct, literally, the reason why he has changed that, because he couldn't make any sense. How can he be fully aware while sleeping, right? So he changed it into falling asleep. This is what is going on here. So the problem here is that actually the translation is slightly, in my opinion, slightly off. And the best way to translate this, which is fully acceptable according to Pali grammar and all this, is you act in full awareness in regard to walking, in regard to standing, in regard to sitting, in regard to sleeping, in regard to waking up, in regard to talking, in regard to keeping silent. In other words, the point is not that you have full awareness all the time, but you have full awareness about these activities. You know why you do them. So full awareness in regard to sleep or about sleep means you know how much you need to sleep, what is the right amount, when to get up, when to go to bed, all these kind of things. The same thing with being awake, the same thing with talking. It's about these things rather than actually during the activity necessarily. If you have full awareness during the activity, it means that you have incredibly powerful mindfulness. This is not really what is meant here. It's more a general idea of whether this activity is appropriate or not. That changes that whole thing a little bit and actually makes sense of something which otherwise does not really make sense in this particular sutta. So for those of you who are deeply into the sutta, that's the kind of thing, small little thing that actually makes a little bit of difference. For those of you who are beginners, you're probably baffled by this kind of stuff. You wonder, what on earth is this all about? And that's okay. This is kind of meant to be a little bit for everyone. So that's kind of the point of this. So that is the passage on clear comprehension or full awareness on the Buddhist path. And it kind of comes really under right effort. Sometimes it is said to be part of right mindfulness because it also, this particular passage also, not this passage, but yes, this passage is also found in the Satipatthana Sutta. But really, I think it belongs outside of Satipatthana, and this is what my good friend Ajahn Sujato has actually pointed out in his book, History of Mindfulness, which if you are new to Buddhism, don't read that one. Read it only after having been a Buddhist for at least 10 years. Otherwise, you're going to be completely baffled by what is going on here. But it's a very interesting book in many ways. So, and it's, of course, available on the internet for free for anyone who's interested. History of Mindfulness is called that. So he has made that point, and I think that seems to me to be very, very correctly pointed out that is the case. So this is that full awareness. So then, this is the last part of right effort. Now we're going to soon be moving into right mindfulness. But then comes this little passage here, which kind of is the transition phase, if you like, between right effort and right mindfulness. Possessing this no aggregate of noble virtue, possessing this noble restraint of the faculties, and possessing this noble mindfulness and full awareness, or just full awareness if you like, he resorts to a secluded resting place. The forest, the root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket, an open space, a heap of straw. Yeah, so now you have built up, you possess all of these things. They're all called noble. Isn't that kind of nice? It means that as you practice these things, you're becoming like a noble person. Yeah, this is kind of what nobility is in Buddhism. It's actually the quality of your heart, the quality of your virtue. That is what makes you a noble person from Buddhism. It doesn't mean that you're born into a noble clan. It means the quality of your character is what makes you noble. It's a very beautiful idea. So all of these qualities are noble qualities. And once you have these noble qualities, and this is kind of the important point here, you resort to a secluded resting place. Yeah, in other words, you withdraw from ordinary society, you withdraw from your fellow monastics to some extent, and you kind of find a place far away, because now you're going to get serious about meditation practice. And this is what this really means. Whenever you see meditation practice mentioned in the suttas, always it tends to start off with resorting to a secluded resting place. This is an indication, it's an indicator that now we're dealing with meditation practice. So that is already interesting, right? The idea that meditation happens in seclusion. It happens kind of far away from society, far away from other things. And there are many reasons for that, but one of the reasons why that is the case is because sometimes when you aren't in your ordinary circumstances, in your ordinary house, with your ordinary family, with your ordinary job and all these things, you're so enmeshed in all that kind of stuff. You're so much part of it. It's very hard to find peace of mind. All the attachments, the cravings around you make it difficult to really kind of really relax in that kind of situation. So it's like one reason for seclusion is to take you out of your ordinary environment and then place you somewhere where you don't have much relationship to a particular place. This is why it's nice to come to a place like this. Yeah, you're away from your family, your house, your job, and all the ordinary things. And even though this is not really, can't really call it secluded, we're kind of living very closely together in many ways, still, there is a degree of seclusion simply because you remove yourself from your ordinary life. That is already a degree of seclusion, already a positive thing going on. This is the first thing. For the second thing is a higher degree of seclusion, where you really are completely by yourself, and you stay in the kuti, far away from anyone else. And if you, for example, if you came to our monastery in Perth, our monastery is made up in such a way that every kuti is pretty much so far away from every other kuti that you cannot see anybody else. When you're in your kuti, it's like you feel really secluded. You feel kind of far away from other people. This is a kind of the idea of a good monastery, is to give you access to this kind of seclusion. This is kind of the purpose of this. And that is where meditation happens, yeah? This is where the real meditation happens. So this is kind of an important thing to take into account. So on a retreat like this, you can expect to get better meditation than usual, but if you want really deep meditation, usually you have to go be even more secluded than this. Not absolutely necessary, but it's helpful. And then you have the examples, right? The forest, the root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charnel ground. Charnel ground are really good because nobody likes charnel grounds. So you are really secluded on the charnel ground. A jungle thicket, an open space, or a heap of straw. So what happens? Now we are moving on to Sammasati, the seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, which is Satipatthana, of course. So I will read out the next paragraph and then discuss it briefly here. On returning from alms round after his meal, he sits down, folding his legs crosswise, setting his body erect, and establishing mindfulness before him. Abandoning covetousness for the world, he abides with a mind free from covetousness. He purifies his mind from covetousness. Abandoning ill will and hatred, he abides with a mind free from ill will, compassionate for the welfare of all living beings. He purifies his mind from ill will and hatred. Abandoning sloth and torpor, abandoning tiredness and lethargy, he abides free from tiredness and lethargy, recipient of life, mindful and fully aware. He purifies his mind from tiredness and lethargy. Abandoning restlessness and remorse, he abides unagitated. With a mind inwardly peaceful, he purifies his mind from restlessness and remorse. Abandoning doubt, he abides, having gone beyond doubt. Unperplexed about wholesome qualities, he purifies his mind from doubt. So these are obviously the five hindrances, the pancha nivarana, right? For those of you who have been Buddhists for a while, you recognize these things straight away. And this is a standard set that you see in the sutta. These are the obstacles for meditation practice. These are dealt with here. Now, the first thing that is kind of that is interesting here is that we have just been talking so much now already about how to overcome problems in the mind, about overcoming ill will and all of these kind of things. Now it comes up again. Why does it come up again after all of these preliminary things of dealing with these defilements? Suddenly talking about the five hindrances again. It sounds like we're talking about the same thing again and again and again. What's the difference here? And the difference is that now we are moving towards the very subtle and refined hindrances in the mind, the things that block you from entering still states of mind, like the samadhi and these kind of things. So the very last remnant of the five hindrances. They have small little sensual desires, like just attachment to the body. They can't go any deeper in the senses. Subtle forms of ill will in the senses. So what we are dealing with here is a very subtle aspect of these hindrances, or a subtle aspect of the defilements, and that is why they come up again here. So the idea here is a gradual abandonment of the defilements, starting with the coarser things, and moving on to the more refined things as we go down there. Yeah, so this is kind of what is going on here. So this is why it occurs so many times, because of the different degrees of refinement of these things. What are these five? And of course, again, you can see here they are, first of all, covetousness. Again, it just means a sensual desire, yeah? Avijja is the Pali word. It means sensual desire for the world. The world here probably refers to the world of the five senses. In other words, the world of the karma loka, of sensual desire. And then we have ill will is the second one, of course, which is vyapada, the second one here. When you see this list of the five hindrances, I think I may have mentioned it already. The idea of the five hindrances, again, is that they too are structured in a kind of sequence. It is not random. So because of that, the most powerful and the kind of the most difficult one to abandon of these hindrances, the one hindrance that support all the other ones, is actually sensual desire. Yeah, we had a look before at this other sutta, and we saw how when there is sensual desire, ill will is often just in the background. And when there is sensual desire and ill will, then restlessness and tiredness and lethargy and doubt and all these other qualities also tend to come along here. So by far the most important of these five hindrances are the first two. This is important because people often come and say, oh, how do I abandon tiredness? I feel tired in my meditation. How do I get rid of this? How do I get rid of all this restless mind? Always thinking. And the answer is, usually, instead of trying to overcome these things, we should focus on the first two of the five hindrances. That is where the real problems tend to be. And by abandoning those, the other hindrances tend to fall by the wayside at the same time. That is an important thing to recognize, because otherwise we can spend too much time trying to overcome tiredness, when actually tiredness is not really the root of the problem. The root of the problem might be a little bit of ill will, which tends to make the mind tired after a while. Or sensual desire, which has always to do with craving and agitation. And because it has to do with that, it also tires the mind out, and it makes you tired and slothful and these kind of things. So very important to put in the effort where it really works, and not get put in the effort in the wrong kind of place. Then we have these other hindrances, and the last hindrance here is doubt, right? People often ask what doubt means on the five hindrances, and it actually explains right here what it means. What it means is doubt about what qualities are wholesome and what qualities are unwholesome. That is really what it means on the Buddhist path. It doesn't mean all kinds of other kinds of doubt. Sometimes people think doubt means, oh, I'm not sure if I can do it or not. Is that what it meant by doubt? Not really, huh? Not really meant by that. You can do it, right? And this is one of the things of people say, if you have a mind, then you can do it. If you are human, you can do it. If you are not human, then the rest of us might get very scared. You turn out to be a ghost or something like that. But doubt here is doubt about wholesome qualities. We know through your own investigation where the wholesome qualities are and where the unwholesome qualities are here. And this, again, is part of the investigation, right? We have seen the Satipatthana investigation, Dhammavicaya, Sambhojanga. All of this is all about kind of dividing the mind into those two camps, good qualities, bad qualities. And after a while, eventually, when you get to real samadhi, you will have full understanding of what is going on here, because then doubt will have been completely abandoned while you are, at least while in that state of samadhi, and then you will, for the first time, have real clarity about this. That is what is meant by these things. But of course, the most interesting thing here is that this passage just says you abandon these things. It doesn't say anything about how to abandon them, right? It just tells you, abandon these things. Okay, what am I supposed to do? And the clue to understanding what is going on here is the very first phrase that you see here. After his arms round, you sit down, yeah? You fold your legs crosswise, set your body erect, and you establish mindfulness before you. And this is the standard, another standard phrase in the sutta that you see everywhere, which indicates that now we're talking about meditation practice. You're talking about sitting down, watching your breath, and that kind of stuff. So I will have a look at these little other factors in a second, but that is what it means. So what this passage actually refers to is actually Satipatthana practice. Yeah, Satipatthana practice is all about, precisely about, really, when you look at the Satipatthana Sutta, it's all about overcoming defilements of the mind and problems in the mind. Satipatthana is something that we do during formal meditation as part of sitting down meditation practice. So this here is really Satipatthana. Yeah, it's not obvious. It doesn't say anywhere this is about Satipatthana, but that is exactly, it fits in the path, exactly where it should fit in to be Satipatthana practice. Because the next thing after this is Samadhi, the jhanas, and all that kind of thing. And this is the last thing you do before you enter those jhanas. So this is Satipatthana practice. If you remember Satipatthana Sutta, it starts off with the Kaya Nupassana, the contemplation of the body. And the idea of contemplation of the body is to abandon some of the attachment to the body and the five senses, so as to enable you to kind of go deeper into samadhi, abandon some of the defilements there. The classic way of doing that is the 31 parts of the body. You don't have to do that. All you have to do is you just watch the breath, but that is a possibility. You can do some of the 31 parts of the body. Then you have the Vedana Nupassana of the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the contemplation of feeling. And if you look at those contemplational feelings, it is really divided into two categories. The feelings that are related to defilements, and the feelings that are related to the pure-minded. Yeah, so again, it's about understanding the distinction between defilements and purity. And when you understand that, to move towards the purity. You have the Chittanupassana, contemplation of the mind, or contemplation of mind qualities. Exactly the same idea again. It's the idea of the distinction between defiled and undefiled mental qualities is the main distinction that you see there. So again, understanding those things. And the last one, the Dhammanupassana, which can be translated as, I think, a contemplation of principles, a contemplation of conditionality, a contemplation of something like that, of the cause and effect, if you want. And if you read that part of the sutta, it becomes very clear what is going on. The five hindrances, you have to understand them. First of all, what they are, whether they are present or not. What causes them? What is it that causes sensual desire? What causes sensual desire is how we look upon an object. If you look upon an object and you see the beautiful qualities in it, sensual desire will arise. That's how it works. If you look upon an object and you kind of see the, or you look at the person and you see all the negative qualities, ill will can arise. It's as simple as that. If you look carefully, you will see this is the causality. This is how these things happen. So you see the causality, where it comes from. You see how it stops by not focusing on that thing which gives rise to it. And you understand how it does not come to arise again in the future by practicing samadhi, for example. This is the kind of the whole, you understand very broadly the conditionality that is the background for how these five hindrances actually come to exist in the first place. And now you're starting to get a very good understanding of how the mind works, right? And through that understanding of how the mind works, it becomes relatively easy to learn how to avoid these five hindrances. If you don't want sensual desire to arise, well, you don't look at that beautiful aspect in that person or in that thing that you desire. Instead of looking at its beauty, you remind yourself it's impermanent, it's uncertain. If I attach to it, it's going to give rise to suffering. So you look at some other aspect of that person instead. And by doing that, your sensual desire does not arise as a consequence. This is one way of abandoning sensual desire, right? To look at a different aspect of that object you're looking at. The whole idea of Satipatthana practice is really this idea of purifying your mind from the very last defilements, and then bringing it together, unifying it, and then taking it to samadhi as a consequence of that. So this is what it's about. Now, it all sounds quite complicated, right? All of these different factors, contemplating or Vedanizing, all of these things. How do we actually do this? Again, it's not entirely clear how we do that. How do we contemplate feelings? And there are many different kind of meditation techniques. If you go to the Goenka technique, that says feel the feelings in the body, right? You kind of feel, you kind of contemplate the feelings, or you experience the feelings in the body. But the Buddha doesn't really say anywhere that this is the way that it should be done. He does mention feelings generally. He talks about feelings here and there. He doesn't give a very clear description, except for one place. There's only one place where the Buddha describes very clearly how the whole Satipatthana practice can be done. And where is that? It's in the Anapanasati Sutta. He says, Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, and we'll have a look at that in a second, takes you from the beginning to the very end of Satipatthana. You practice the full Satipatthana just by watching the breath. That is all that is required. It's quite simple. Yeah, it's easy. It makes it easy. You don't have to worry too much about how these things are done, because that is the one place where the Buddha explains how it is done. And if the Buddha explains this is how you do it, why not follow that instruction? That's kind of how I tend to think. Well, this is what the Buddha says, so I'll follow that instruction. And that is why I like to take that as my main meditation object, the breath, precisely because this is how the Buddha explains. You practice the whole, everything, family, the five hindrances, the four satipatthanas, mindfulness of breathing, it all comes together in just watching the breath. And that's all you have to do. And you may wonder, for those of you who know the Satipatthana Sutta, it has at the very, under the Kaya Nupassana contemplation of the body, it has a section there which is actually breath meditation under the contemplation of the body. Which is kind of weird, because from that it looks like the breath contemplation or breath meditation is reduced only to the body contemplation part, not the contemplation of feeling, contemplation of mind, and all the other stuff. It looks like it's kind of limited just to the body contemplation. So again, going back to Ajahn Siddhartha's marvelous study of the Satipatthana, he points out that quite likely that is not what it originally was. Originally it wasn't like that. Originally it probably wasn't even a part of body contemplation. It was a later kind of addition to that one. The Satipatthana Sutta is one of those sutras that has expanded over time. That is one of the kind of the arguments he makes. And I think the argument is very solid. It's very hard to avoid that conclusion when you look at all the evidence. You look at the Satipatthana Sutta as it exists in Chinese, etc. And it's very different. There are all kind of different things coming in there. There must have been some development of that sutra. And once you take that out of the Satipatthana Sutta, then of course it makes sense that the breath meditation actually fulfills not just body contemplation, but it fulfills the entire Satipatthana, all the way through, from the beginning to the very end. Just as it says in the Anapanasati Sutta. Okay, I'm not sure if I'm making any sense. I hope I'm making a little bit of sense, because it doesn't really matter that much, because I'm just kind of saying these things for those of you who know quite a bit about the suttas, because these are little things, little pointers that I think are quite interesting, and they kind of broaden out the scope of what is going on. For those people who are more new to Buddhism, actually I recognize it can be quite hard to follow these little points, but in the broader picture, I think they can be quite interesting. That's why I mentioned them. So we have now established that the way to abandon these five hindrances is Anapanasati, right? We can just do that, and that also includes the Satipatthana, the right mindfulness. So because of that, now is the time to have a look at the Anapanasati Sutta. Yeah, so let's move to the Anapanasati Sutta. And that comes just after the last sutta we looked at before. Just after Fools and Wise Men, we have the Mindfulness of Breathing Sutta. So now we are moving deeply into the territory of the seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. This is all about Samma, Sati, right mindfulness, and Satipatthana, etc. So this is how this famous sutta reads. And one of the interesting things, again, about mindfulness of breathing is that it is mentioned in many places in the suttas. So we can take it as a very important way of meditation practice. In fact, I think if anything can be considered meditation in the Sutta, this is really the kind of the apparently most important aspect of meditation practice. This is how it goes. Because when mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is of great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it fulfills the four applications of mindfulness. When the four applications of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they fulfill the seven factors of awakening. When the seven factors of awakening are developed and cultivated, they fulfill insight and liberation. Yeah, that's what I just mentioned before, that when you properly cultivate anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, all the way, it fulfills the four applications of mindfulness. In other words, that's all you have to do. You don't have to do anything else apart from that. You complete it from the beginning to the end. So it's quite handy. Yeah, there's only one thing you have to do. You don't have to make it too complicated or anything like that. And when not only do you fulfill the four applications of mindfulness, but in the process, it actually takes you all the way to awakening itself, just by watching the breath. So the breath, this simple little breath, right, takes you all the way to awakening. It's quite nice. So let's find out how to do the mindfulness of breathing. And how, because is mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated so that it is of great fruit and great benefit? Here, a bhikkhu gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or to an empty hut sits down, having folded his legs crosswise, sets his body erect and establishes mindfulness in front of him. Ever mindful, he breathes in. Mindful, he breathes out. So here, the most interesting, in many ways, the most interesting part of the sutta is in that particular paragraph. Because that particular paragraph gives you the background, the foundation for how mindfulness of breathing happens. Yeah, so of course the point is you have to get these things right. Only when these things are right is the mindfulness of breathing going to happen. Because you have to kind of put that in there first of all. So again, you see this idea of going into seclusion, having gone to the forest, the root of a tree, or an empty hut. Very similar to what we saw before. The idea of seclusion, you go to an empty hut, yeah? And then you sit down. Meditation, when you do anapanasati or you do satipatthana practice, usually it happens when you sit down. It's a sitting type of meditation. You fold your legs crosswise, and this was a standard way of sitting at the time of the Buddha. I don't think it means that you actually have to do that. It's quite okay to sit on a chair. But obviously that the position of sitting cross-legged is actually quite nice once you get used to it. It's quite stable and it feels quite good. But you don't have to do it. You can sit on a chair. I know many people who get good meditation by sitting on a chair as well. So I think the main point there is it's sort of the standard way of doing things at that time. You set your body erect, yeah, because it gives a sense of clarity. Again, remember that setting your body erect also depends a little bit on time and place. Don't do it if you feel really tired or anything like that. Sometimes you just need to rest a little bit first of all. It's okay to lean against the wall and just relax for a while. And then when you feel the mindfulness comes, then you start to set your body erect. You can almost feel, it feels like you have to do it because it feels natural, because your mindfulness becomes stronger. But many people I know who are incredibly good meditators, they start off by just leaning back and just resting there. Just chilling out, because you can rest better when you lean back. So you just relax. And then when you relax, you get into the pleasant moment. Then when the pleasant moment arises, then you kind of straighten up naturally as a consequence. So everything is time and place, right? Nothing is kind of just automatic. Don't do things like a robot because it says so in the sutta. This happens too often, right? It says in the sutta, you must sit cross-legged because you can't do mindfulness of breathing in any other posture. But it's going too far. It just means this is the ideal posture, the way they did it at the time of the Buddha. It doesn't mean it's absolutely required. So we have to be a little bit circumspect with these things. And then the last one, which is the most important one, having established mindfulness in front of you. Yeah, and this is kind of the whole point that I've been pointing out all the time. you actually have to establish that mindfulness before you do the anapanasati, before you watch the breath. And this is what it says here. Having established it means you do it beforehand. And the reason for that is because unless the mindfulness is already strong enough, as long as you still have fairly strong defilements in your mind, you will not be able to just sit back and watch. Yeah, because your mind will be kind of taken this way and that way by the defilements, taken into the future by the desire, taken into the past by the ill will. And you just won't be able to stay in the present moment. And because you won't be able to do it, what's going to happen? You're going to use willpower and force yourself onto that breath. And when you use willpower to kind of grasp the breath, the meditation is going to be unpleasant. It's not going to be at ease. It's not going to be relaxed. It's not going to be the natural mindfulness that you require to actually go into deeper into the meditation. It should be a relaxed kind of mindfulness where you're sitting back and you feel almost as if there is a distance between you and the object, as if the object can leave at any time because you're not controlling it. And so it does, right? Of course, everyone has thoughts every now and again. So a thought arises, the meditation, the breath disappears. That's perfectly okay. You don't control it. It's like a friend that you don't try to control, as I was saying last night. So you allow it to go. And suddenly you become aware that you're thinking. And as soon as you become aware of that, the breath tends to come back all by itself. You don't have to bring the breath back. You don't have to do anything. Because when the mindfulness re-arises, you're already there with the breath again. And in this way, it becomes a very natural and very easy way of doing the meditation practice. So you just sit there and you see all of these things happening. Breath is there. Breath is gone. You don't panic when the breath is gone. Oh no, what happened to the breath? If you panic, it means you grasp onto things and you kind of use willpower again. So establish mindfulness first. And there's two ways of establishing mindfulness. And of course, the first way is the thing that we do on the retreat when you're here. And you just sit back, you make the present moment the pleasant moment, you give priority to the mindfulness and all of these kind of things. And then mindfulness will arise to a certain extent. But the more profound way of giving rise to mindfulness is all the things that we do in daily life. Yeah, all the practices that you do on the path, the way you kind of fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path in ordinary life, that is how, in the long run, mindfulness tends to arise. So, watch yourself. This is actually kind of the idea behind this. Watch yourself when you go from one retreat to the next one. Yeah, and you will see that the idea is that when you go on your next retreat, ideally your mind should be in a slightly better state than it is now. You should have a bit more mindfulness, a bit more ability to stay with the breath, a bit less defilements in the mind, more kind of bit more gentle, right? A bit more kind-hearted. All of those good qualities will have arisen. And then you know that you're practicing in the right way. You know that your lifestyle is actually working and is supporting supporting progress on the Noble Eightfold Path. This is the way to see that. And if it isn't improving, don't panic because it isn't improving. A lot of people say, oh, my meditation isn't going anywhere. What's happening here? It's a very common thing. But that should be a cause for you to look more carefully into what is happening in your life. Yeah, you should reflect, why isn't it working out? What's going on here? What is the reason? What can I improve on? How can I purify myself further? That is the right way of thinking if it isn't happening here. So the idea is that meditation retreats are a great opportunity to take stock of your general practice and to see how you're going, if mindfulness is arising or not. So this is the point here. So you establish or you allow mindfulness to become established, yeah? And that is the starting point. And then the meditation really starts. And then it says here, ever mindful you breathe in, ever mindful you breathe out. Which I think is a bad translation. Not bad, but not quite precise. More precise would be just mindful you breathe in, just mindful you breathe out. In other words, you are just mindful. You don't control anything here. You don't try to make the breath this way or that way here. You are just mindful. It's just mindfulness and nothing else. You're just the observer. You're just watching what is going on here and not controlling it. So whatever gives a slightly different emphasis, it gives the idea that you're always mindful here. But always mindful comes further down because at this point, mindfulness is still not 100% stronger. It becomes stronger as we move on here. So, you are mindful. And then, this is what happens when you practice this mindfulness of breathing here. Breathing in long, you understand, I breathe in long. Or breathing out long, you understand, I breathe out longer. Breathing in short, you understand, I breathe in shorter. Or breathing out short, you understand, I breathe out shorter. You train thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body of breath. You train thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body of breath. You train thus, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily formation. You train thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formation. So, I'll explain what is going on here, because it's not at all obvious what is happening with some of these things. So it starts off with breathing in long. You understand that, right? And this does not mean, as sometimes people think, that you make your breath long or anything like that. What it means is that just that you are aware of the breath. When you first sit down, your breath tends to be quite long. This is the reason why it says long here to begin with. So you are just aware of that. You are aware of the fact that the breath is long. In other words, you are aware of the quality of the breath. You have to focus on something. So you're just aware of the breath, really. That's really all it means. And then as you become a little bit more peaceful, sometimes the breath will become shorter, because, or maybe more shallow, maybe the right word is saying it. You don't deep so breathe anymore, more shallow perhaps. Yeah, and that is a sec, that's why you are kind of becoming a bit more peaceful, it becomes more shallow. In these cases, it says understands. The next one, it says trains. And I think the reason why it says understand is because this is a natural consequence of having given rise to mindfulness. You don't have to train. If mindfulness is there, this happens all pretty much automatically there. You're aware of the long breath, then you are aware of the short breath, then one after the other. Then comes the third factor, and it says trains. So what does it mean to train? It does not, again, it may sound like it means using willpower, trying to get something, trying to move towards something. But what it really means here, I think, it just means that it takes time before this happens. You have to practice the Noble Eightfold Path, you have to practice the mindfulness of breathing, and it takes time, and eventually you get there. So training just means being patient with what is going on, and allowing things to settle down. It does not mean taking charge and kind of being the agent behind these things, because then usually you just mess it up as a consequence. So what is it that we're training in here? What is that we're trying to achieve? And it says experiencing the whole body. Sabbakaya Patisamvedi is the Pali word for this. And this is one of those phrases that people argue over their whole life. I'm sure Arya Vimala would know about that, because this is kind of this is one of those things that everyone who has been practicing this thing seriously for a long time will know about. What does it mean? Sabbakaya Patisamvedi. And in the this is interpreted differently. In the Goenka tradition, it said this means literally experiencing the whole body. In the commentary, it says it means experiencing the whole breath, the whole body of the breath. Because the word kaya has many meanings apart from body. It means like an accumulation of things, right? So what does it mean? Does it mean experiencing the whole physical body? Or does it mean experiencing the whole body of the breath? In other words, instead of just knowing the breath a little bit, you start to know the entirety of the breath. From the moment it goes in, all the way out again. Your awareness is expanding, so you see more of that. And I must admit, I think that it refers to the breath personally. I think there are some very good reasons for thinking that, but not the least that we are doing Anapanasati. It's the Anapanasati Sutta. We're not doing really body contemplation of the physical body, we're watching the breath. So I personally think that that's what it means. Other people see it differently. It's interesting, Venerable Analia, who was here today, he takes it to mean the full physical body. We didn't actually argue this particular point, because I think there's not kind of much point in arguing. We kind of exhausted all our arguments, and we're still holding to our respective positions, so there's no point in arguing any further. So there are differences of opinion, but to me, I feel fairly convinced that this must actually refer to the breath, because this is all about Anapanasati. And it seems to me you're naturally kind of moving from one state of the breath to more and more refined states of the breath as you move on. So that is how I understand that. But don't worry too much about it. The most important thing is that the meditation is going in the right direction. You're feeling more peaceful. And then you continue after this. You continue with calming down the breath anyway. So everything has ultimately lead to the same place. You don't have to argue too much about these things. But that's the interpretation I'm going to give you, because that is the way I look at that. And then, once you are aware of the whole body, then of course you continue the calming down of the experience and tranquilizing the bodily formation. Bodily formation is another word for the breath, specifically in the sutta as you find that. So now you are tranquilizing the breath itself. The breath is becoming more peaceful. Yeah, so this, you can see the stages here. First of all, you are aware very simply whether the breath is going in and out. The way I have been trained, the way Ajahn Brahm teaches this, is that you don't have to be aware of the breath in any particular place. Very commonly you hear you should feel it on your nostril or something like that. But I like kind of Ajahn Brahm's technique. All you have to do is be aware that the breath is going in or out. That's really all you have to do. How you are aware of that, where you are aware of that, is completely irrelevant. Close your eyes. You can always know that it's going in. You can know it's going out. Yeah, that's all you have to, that's kind of knowledge we're talking about. And then you expand the awareness, so the, you know, the whole breath from the beginning to the end, and then you tranquilize things. This is how the process happens here. Of course, there is overlap here. These are not kind of completely discrete, independent stages, but this is kind of the general process. So that is the first part, and that is roughly equal to the Kaya Vipassana in the Satipatthana Sutta. Then, the second part is equal to the Vedana Vipassana of the Satipatthana Sutta, and it goes as follows. You train thus, I shall breathe in experiencing rapture. This is piti. He trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing rapture. He trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing pleasure. He trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing pleasure. This is sukha. He trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing the mental formation, the citta sankhara. He trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing the mental formation. He trains thus, I shall breathe in tranquilizing the mental formation. He trains thus, I shall breathe out tranquilizing the mental formation. So what is happening here is that as you're tranquilizing the breath, right, in the previous one, again, you're not actually doing this. This is happening automatically as you are watching the breath. You're just standing back and allowing this, all of this to happen by itself. As you do that, there comes a point when joy starts to arise in the mind. Everything becomes so peaceful and so beautiful. And this, combined with the fact that you have kind of been living very pure life and you feel generally good about yourself, will allow joy to arrive at this particular point. Happens automatically, yeah? You don't have to do any of this. And that is why, at this point, you start to experience rapture. And this is exactly what we were talking about before, at the very beginning of the retreat. We were looking at the psychology of meditation, right? Piti comes, this kind of piti, that often the physical feeling of piti, mental and physical, kind of coming together. Yeah, and this is a kind of strong sense of rapture, or joy, or whatever you want to call it, that comes at this particular point. Then, and that calms down a little bit, and then you experience the pleasure, the sukha. The sukha is a more happy, even more happy, higher degree of happiness, that is more peaceful than the piti. One stage after the other, one a bit more coarse, next one a bit more refined. You train experience the mental formation. The mental formation in the sutta means just is a combination of perception and feeling. So it is whatever is happening in your mind, that is a mental formation. So what is happening in your mind at this moment is mostly just happiness. There's not much more going on. There's a little bit of breath is still there in the background. There may be a little bit of light and things coming up at this stage, maybe even some images coming up as the mind becomes peaceful in this way. Some people have very creative minds and they see all kinds of stuff. It's amazing what people can see in the meditation. Some people see absolutely nothing. All they see is the breath, you know. Some people see, wow, look, you know, sceneries and all kind of things. And at this point, you often think that you're seeing your past lives sometimes because you see all these kind of things. All of that is part of the mental formation. Yeah, so you are aware of all the things that is happening here. And then you tranquilize. The next step here is to tranquilize that mental formation here. You don't get carried away by all the movements, all the things that are happening here. And you tranquilize this further here. And as you do that, the will, at every stage here, the will is becoming weaker here. The doer inside is becoming weaker. Everything becoming more and more passive, more and more still, more and more beautiful. The happiness becoming more and more deep for every stage of this. So this is the Vedananupassana, right? The contemplation of feeling. That's all you're doing. You're just sitting back, watching the breath. All of this is happening pretty much automatically. All you have to do is to be completely passive. Stand back and be aware of it. Okay, can I go? No, maybe I can't. It's already 4 o'clock, but maybe we'll stop. Maybe we can finish the sutta off this evening or something. I think it's nice to kind of finish it off, I think. Yeah. But I better stop there, otherwise it's going to be get too late. Okay, so maybe we can squeeze this in with the Q&A this evening. We'll see what happens. We'll find a way of doing it anyway. So until then, I will see you again at 7:30 this evening.